They invested in Slack. They invested them in when they were a different company and pivoted to become what they are, and a whole bunch of other companies that you would know. Jim, you know, believed the same thing that I believed, that Carnegie Mellon was an underutilized resource and that we could use the talent that came through Carnegie Mellon to build great companies and to build great economies. And so at its core, that's what the Swart Center is about, is to attract the best and the brightest and to help them by providing them the tools and the resources to actually be able to take their ideas and turn them into reality. We have 24 different programs and clubs at the Swart Center. It's not a one-size-fits-all capability. Anybody that comes in is going to take a different path than the others. We have a venture fund called Venture Bridge. We have a competition called the McGinnis Venture Competition. Some of my favorite programs are like the programs that you're in, Archant, the Innovation Scholars. And the Innovation Scholars is like a sorority or a fraternity for high potential entrepreneurs. And we have high diversity in that group. We have people from the different schools across campus. We have people from different ethnic origins. We have people from different lifestyles. You name a way to look at diversity, that's what we have. You're an innovation scholar. Why don't you tell us really quickly what an innovation scholar is? I'll be the interviewer now.
I would say that Innovation Scholars has been a really good program for learning that entrepreneurship is a real thing that you can do. I think when I first came to college, I was like everybody else. I wanted to get that, you know, shiny looking job at Google. But I quickly found out that the thing that would fulfill me the best was probably working at a startup. I just didn't know how to make that real. And Innovation Scholars allowed me to connect with other students of the other Innovation Scholars, as well as meet this wide variety of really incredible people, these founders, these investors that we met when we went on our trip to Silicon Valley. So every winter break, the Innovation Scholars get taken on a week-long trip to Silicon Valley. And overall, it's been a really positive experience. So,
yeah. And the amazing thing to me, Archon, is that the alumni from Innovation Scholars are absolutely killing it. I can't believe how many great companies have been started by people that have been in the program that you were. You mentioned Matt Spatel a little bit earlier from Trainwell. Stella Hahn started Fractional, a way for friends to buy investment real estate properties together. Glenn Wise came to CMU last week. He started a cybersecurity company called Cinder. Mohawk Nada started a company called Atlas to make it easier to get visas to go back and forth to India and China and other places. I mean, the people that have been in this program are really creating life-changing companies. And that's what our goal is that we didn't do that. Those people did it on their own. You know, they came up with the ideas. They made these things happen. But we hopefully created an environment that gave them the confidence to do it and some of the resources they needed to get there.
I'd love to hear a little bit more about that environment. Paul Graham, the founder of Y Combinator, probably the biggest accelerator in the world.
The biggest and the best in most people's minds.
Yeah. He grew up in Monroeville, so he did.
He's a Pittsburgh native, yeah.
And he gave this talk on the future of Pittsburgh as a startup hub. He seems to be bullish about it. But one of the things that he talked about was these organic conditions for entrepreneurship to occur. Mm-hmm. Things that happen to correlate with founders meeting each other and starting really cool startups that go on to do big things. What are some of those organic conditions that you think are most important for the development of a healthy startup ecosystem?
Community, a sense of community, a sense of belonging, a place to go. And that's what we didn't have before the Swart Center, and we do have right now. Now, the Swart Center can't be the only place and the only community that we have in town. And I think that's what Paul's talking about. You know, he started off in Boston with Y Combinator and moved it to the Bay Area. The Bay Area has all these micro communities that are just incredible. We're not going to try to recreate what's going on in the Bay Area, but we can create these micro communities that are here in Pittsburgh, the Swart Center being one of them. So I think if you get these micro communities that are, you know, successful and vibrant in and of themselves, working with other micro communities to build a larger ecosystem, then you can have that success. And so, you know, I'm very proud of what our team has built at the Swart Center, but we need more of that in more places. So I would like to see the University of Pittsburgh build upon the microculture and the micro community that they have there right now. I would like to see us be able to do that in downtown. What you've seen with Carnegie Mellon is the influence on Lawrenceville and the Strip District through Robotics Row, right? So even though that's connected to Carnegie Mellon, its own micro community down along the Allegheny River. So if we can do more of that by creating these hubs of, you know, startup activity, I think we have a chance to be what Paul Graham thinks we can be.
It's been really great having you on the show, Dave. Again, this is Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. I'm your host, Archon Das. I was here with Dave Mawinney, director of the Swartz Center for Entrepreneurship at Carnegie Mellon's Tepper School of Business. Thanks, Dave.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
As we watch Trump eliminate federal agencies, fire workers, and stop payments to Americans, a lot of people around the country and back home are asking, frankly, what the hell is the plan?
As Musk accuses one of the agencies he's trying to shut down of being a criminal operation, is Doge acting like a criminal operation, illegally accessing the private financial and health information of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands or more, of Americans? As one of the Doge staffers is forced to resign, had written on a now-deleted social media post, "Normalize Indian Hate," we'll speak with Indian-American Silicon Valley Congressmember Ro Khanna, who knows Musk.
Trump and Elon Musk and their unqualified, unelected, unwanted henchmen want to be able to carry out their attacks on your environment.
Then we'll speak to the former head of the EPA's Environmental Justice Program, which is under attack by the Trump administration. We'll also talk to the former head of the Office of Personnel Management and Public Citizen about their lawsuits against Doge. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Trump's imposed sanctions on the International Criminal Court over its war crimes investigations against Israel. The executive order issued Thursday accuses the ICC of engaging in, quote, illegitimate and baseless actions targeting America and our close ally Israel, unquote. It also says the ICC abused its power when it issued, quote, baseless arrest warrants for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and former Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant over war crimes and crimes against humanity, reiterating, quote, the ICC has no jurisdiction over the United States or Israel, unquote. Trump's action coincided with Netanyahu's visit to Capitol Hill Thursday, where he met with leaders of both parties. Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson said he was caught off guard by Trump's proposal and was awaiting details, but nonetheless praised it.
Look, there'll be more details forthcoming on that, of course. The initial announcement yesterday, I think, was greeted by surprise by many, but cheered by, I think, people all around the world. Why? Because that area is so dangerous, and he's taking bold, decisive action to try to ensure the peace of that region.
Human rights groups and many world leaders have condemned the United States for welcoming Netanyahu and refusing to serve the ICC arrest warrant against him. Reed Brody is a veteran war crimes prosecutor.
Well, of course, this decision was expected, but nevertheless, it's really threatens to undermine international accountability for the worst crimes and deprive victims all across the globe of justice. This executive order puts the United States on the side of war criminals at the expense of victims of grave crimes seeking justice.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu gifted Trump a golden pager during their meeting at the White House. referencing Israel's deadly booby-trap attacks on Lebanon in September, which killed dozens of people and injured thousands more when thousands of pagers blew up at the same time. President Trump is doubling down on his proposal for the United States to seize Gaza, saying the besieged territory would be, quote, turned over to the U.S. by Israel after it concludes its war. Trump made the remarks on Truth Social, writing, quote, the Palestinians would have already been resettled in far safer and more beautiful communities with new and modern homes in the region. They would actually have a chance to be happy, safe, and free. No soldiers by the U.S. would be needed, unquote, Trump wrote. The Wall Street Journal reported Pentagon officials have received no formal request to draft a plan for U.S. troop deployment to Gaza. Meanwhile, even some Republicans have come out in opposition, including Senator Lindsey Graham, who said other Senate Republicans oppose sending U.S. troops to Gaza. Residents of Gaza compared Trump's plan to the 1948 Nakba and the violent displacement of Palestinians from their land over the past decades.
I believe that this plan is destined to fail. Why? Because since the occupation of Palestine in 1948, this project has been proposed by occupiers and nations that support occupation regarding the issue of displacing the population of the Gaza Strip, but failed due to the steadfastness of our people in the face of this decision. Of course, the occupation will also fail in this war of extermination that began on October 7th, 2023.
Israel continues to violate the ceasefire agreement as Israeli soldiers shot dead two Palestinians, including a child, in southern Gaza on Wednesday. The White House says President Trump plans to keep only 294 staff at the U.S. Agency for International Development out of the agency's total of over 10,000 workers around the world, cutting the staff by about 97%. The remaining USAID workers would include just 12 in the Africa Bureau, 8 in the Asia Bureau. This comes after Trump earlier this week ordered nearly the entire USAID staff to be placed on administrative leave beginning today, and ordered thousands of personnel working overseas to return to the U.S. USAID distributed nearly $44 billion in aid during fiscal year 2023. About three of every five foreign assistance dollars worldwide. The Senate's voted 53-47 along party lines to confirm Russell Vogt, head of the Office of Management and Budget. Vogt is an architect of Project 2025, a radical playbook to seize executive power and to radically reshape federal agencies. Last year, Vogt told undercover reporters his plans for mass deportations, restricting abortion, gutting independent government bureaucracies, and using the military against racial justice protesters. Vogt also said he would work to paint federal workers as villains and, quote, put them in trauma in order to drastically reduce the size of the federal civilian workforce. This is Democratic Senator Angela Alsobrooks of Maryland, who represents over 150,000 federal workers.
They are public servants in the truest sense of the word, who are not guided by party, not moved by vicious news cycles, but they are driven instead by mission. A mission to serve this country to the very best of their ability, under any president of any party. And in just 17 days, this president has put all of their livelihoods on the line. How shameless, how reckless, how callous, how depraved.
On Thursday, a federal judge temporarily blocked the Trump administration's so-called deferred resignation program, offering 8 months' pay and salary to any government worker replying to a mass email sent out by Elon Musk's Doge operation. The judge will revisit the case Monday. The Wall Street Journal reports 25-year-old Doge staff member Marco Elles, who gained access to the Treasury Department's central payment system, resigned Thursday after he was linked to a deleted social media account that advocated racism and eugenics and said, normalize Indian hate. In another apparent breach of sensitive data, CNN reports Energy Secretary Chris Wright granted a 23-year-old former SpaceX intern and Doge staffer access to the Energy Department's IT system. On his social media site, X, Elon Musk has threatened reprisals, including journalists, after Wired magazine named six of his young associates at Doge who are between the ages of 19 and 26. Meanwhile, the White House is preparing an executive order to cut thousands of jobs at the Department of Health and Human Services, including positions at the CDC and FDA. This comes after as several dairy herds in Nevada have just tested positive for a new variant of the H5N1 bird flu virus, raising fresh concerns of a spillover into human populations and a new pandemic. More than 1,000 people gathered for a protest outside the Treasury Department in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday afternoon, denouncing what they called a breach of secure information by Elon Musk and his young associates. The protest came as the Trump administration said it would close the Environmental Protection Agency's Environmental Justice Office and place 168 workers on leave. Meanwhile, lawmakers, including Arizona Congressmember Yasemin Ansari, were denied access as they tried to enter the EPA's headquarters Thursday.
In Phoenix, last year we saw 143 days above 100-degree temperatures. Hundreds of people die on our streets every summer as a result of extreme heat. We also have some of the worst air pollution in the country that we're working to combat. And these attacks on the Environmental Protection Agency cannot stand.
In more Trump cabinet news, the Senate voted 55-44 Wednesday to confirm Scott Turner as Department of Housing and Urban Development Secretary, despite concerns his FBI background check had not been completed. Turner is a former developer and NFL player who's expected to slash the department's multi-billion dollar budget and overhaul affordable housing vouchers as well as programs for unhoused people. Turner's the only African-American member of Trump's cabinet. President Trump's nominated retired Brigadier General Anthony J. Tata, known for his history of Islamophobic and other racist remarks, to a senior Pentagon post charged with overseeing deployments. Tata once called President Obama a terrorist leader. This comes as the Trump administration on Tuesday evicted former Coast Guard Commandant Linda Fagan from her home with 3 hours' notice, without enough time to even gather her personal belongings. She's a four-star admiral and the first woman to lead a branch of the military. She was removed from her post on Trump's second day in office. Homeland Security Department officials cited Fagan's, quote, excessive focus on DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. The Education Department has announced investigations against two universities and a high school sports league for allowing transgender athletes to compete in women's sports. The agency, which Trump has vowed to dismantle, will be probing the University of Pennsylvania and San Jose State University, claiming the institutions have violated civil rights laws over their policy supporting trans athletes in college teams. Meanwhile, trans rights activists are condemning the National Collegiate Athletic Association after its board voted to ban trans women from sports, caving to Trump's executive order, which directs federal agencies to withhold funding for schools that do not comply. The World Meteorological Organization reports January was the warmest since records began, reaching 1.75 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. The January data was a surprise to many scientists, coming despite La Nina conditions that tend to cool the globe. On Sunday, temperatures at the North Pole soared above the freezing point of ice, reaching 36 degrees Fahrenheit above normal for the date. This week, staffers with Elon Musk's Doge operation entered the headquarters of NOAA, that's the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, to access IT systems. They're also reviewing the agency's diversity, equity, and inclusion practices. NOAA's National Marine Fisheries Service has ordered its scientists to stop all contact with foreign colleagues and contacts, including on international treaties and seafood catch limits. Meanwhile, President Trump has nominated Neil Jacobs to reprise his role as acting administrator of NOAA. An investigation found Jacobs violated NOAA's code of ethics in 2019 after defending Trump's false claim that Hurricane Dorian would hit Alabama, the so-called Sharpiegate scandal. The California Public Utilities Commission has received video and data evidence strongly suggesting high voltage transmission lines operated by the electric power company Southern California Edison were responsible for igniting the Eaton Fire, which killed 17 people last month as it swept through the historically black neighborhood of Altadena, destroying 9,400 homes, schools, businesses, and other structures. On Thursday, mourners gathered at First AME Church of Pasadena for a memorial service honoring fire victims. Community members and civil rights leaders are demanding the same federal resources for recovery that LA's most affluent neighborhoods are receiving. They're also warning against shortchanging by insurance companies. Joining the call is Zaire Calvin, who became separated from his sister, Evelyn McClendo, on January 9th as he evacuated the fire with his baby and elderly mother. He returned to find his sister's remains in the rubble of her home.
We want to be made whole. Black people always end up last. I'm just going to say it now. Yes, yeah. We always end up last. Can we just be first in line in this?
This week, the insurance giant State Farm has asked California regulators to approve a rate hike that would see the average homeowner pay 22% more for their premiums. In 2023, State Farm said it would no longer accept new applications for property insurance in California. And last year, it cut 72,000 home and apartment policies across California, citing inflation and, quote, catastrophe exposure. And in India, lawmakers held a protest outside the parliament Thursday, outraged by reports that some 100 Indian immigrants from the United States were kept in shackles during a 40-hour U.S. deportation flight back to India, including during bathroom breaks. This comes days before Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi is expected to meet President Trump at the White House. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Democratic ranking members of several House committees are calling for an investigation of potential national security threats posed by Elon Musk's Doge, that's Department of Government Efficiency. This comes as the Wall Street Journal reports a 25-year-old Doge staff member who gained access to the Treasury Department's central payment system resigned Thursday after he was linked to a deleted social media account that advocated racism and eugenics. In another apparent breach of sensitive data, CNN reports Energy Secretary Chris Wright granted a 23-year-old former SpaceX intern and Doge staffer access to the Energy Department's IT system. In a letter Thursday, Democratic lawmakers urged action to stop Doge by deputy inspectors general at the Treasury Department, the Office of Personnel Management, the Department of Education, the U.S. Agency for International Development, the General Services Administration, and the Small Business Administration. Also Thursday, House Democrats with the Congressional Progressive Caucus demanded Musk be fired from his role in the Trump administration. This is Congressmembers Nydia Velasquez, LaMonica McIver, and First Progressive Caucus Chair Greg Kutzar.
And today we're here to say with one voice, fire Elon Musk. An unelected, unaccountable billionaire now has seemingly unlimited powers over Americans' private data and over Americans' taxpayer dollars.
Do you trust Elon Musk with your most personal financial information, tax records, your social security numbers, your financial security? I don't trust Elon Musk with this information, and I know the American people don't either.
He is trying to puppet master Trump's decisions about everything: women's bodies, immigrants' futures, our kids' education, government funding, on and on and on.
This comes as Republicans on the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee blocked an effort by Democrats Wednesday to subpoena Elon Musk to appear before the panel to face questioning about his ongoing overhaul of the federal government. Our next guest, Democratic Congressmember O'Connor of California, represents Silicon Valley, has called on tech billionaire Elon Musk to be held accountable, but was absent from Wednesday's vote because he says he already had a scheduled meeting with Mexico's ambassador to discuss Trump's tariffs. Rokana posted on X, quote, I would have voted yes. They called a procedural vote without notice, and I, like eight others, didn't make it there on time. Musk's attacks on our institutions are unconstitutional. He should be subpoenaed and answer to our committee. They should call the vote again with notice, he said. For more, Congressmember Rokana joins us from the Cannon Rotunda at the House building on Capitol Hill. He represents Silicon Valley in California. Congressmember Khanna thank you for joining us again. If you can start off by talking about, well, what happened, the possibility that Elon Musk would have been called on the carpet or at least before your committee, and what you're calling for now.
Well, I'm calling for him to be subpoenaed and come before the committee. I put that statement out about 10 minutes after they had the vote and then went to the committee and spoke out about it. And Elon Musk responded, don't be a dick. And we went back and forth on Twitter. But the reality is that he needs to come before the committee. I actually had said when Doge was created, as you know, that if there's wasteful spending in the Pentagon or if he can expose wasteful spending, then I would work to look at that, as did Bernie Sanders, as did Elizabeth Warren. But what he's doing now, which is stopping payments, is unconstitutional. And he needs to come before the committee.
This is Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez speaking on Instagram Live Monday in a message to fellow Democrats in the Senate.
No Democrat should be voting to advance Trump's nominees while all of this stuff is going on. There has to be a political price to pay. And we have a responsibility as a party to block everything that is happening while they're setting a literal match to the federal government and giving 19-year-olds classified access, potentially classified access to the U.S. Treasury Department. So we need to start blocking every single procedural advancement on the Senate side in order to do that.
Your response, Rokana, do you support what AOC is saying?
I do think we should be putting holds on the nominees like Brian Schatz has at the Secretary of State appointees, and that is because of USAID. And I do think we shouldn't be voting to confirm these nominees. But beyond that, the House actually has a lot of power. I mean, the House gets to vote on the debt ceiling. The House gets to vote on government funding. And we should make it very, very clear that until there is an ironclad agreement that everything that the House appropriates and authorizes will be dispersed, we will not vote to increase the debt ceiling. We will not cooperate with Donald Trump on any of the agenda. And I think that will get Trump to fold.
So let me ask you about this Doge Youth Committee, this youth team of Elon Musk, ranging in age between, what is it, 19 and 26. You have senators not being allowed stopped by police by going into the Treasury Department, et cetera. But these young guys are going in, and word is, setting up computers that are downloading servers. The Wall Street Journal reports that the 25-year-old Doge staff member Marco Elez, who gained access to the Treasury Department's central payment system, resigned Thursday after he was linked to a deleted social media account that advocated racism and eugenics. Among other posts, he said something like, I was racist before it was cool. You could not pay me to marry outside my ethnicity and normalize Indian hate. In reference to a post noting Silicon Valley's large Indian community. In June, the account also advocated for the annihilation of Gaza, writing, "I would not mind at all if Gaza and Israel were both wiped off the face of the earth." He worked for Musk at SpaceX and later X. You're an Indian American Congress member from Silicon Valley. So he was forced to resign. But this is this small team that is allowed to move in and have access to what could be what? Thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of workers and just in general Americans' most private economic and health information?
Well, his comments obviously are outrageous. It was totally appropriate that he was fired. I will say, just representing the Bay Area and Silicon Valley for almost 9 years now, that that sentiment is not reflective of the vast, vast majority in the Bay Area. There are other problems, believe me, with tech lobbying and overreach, but his comments really were appalling, and I'm glad he's out. The broader point, though, is that no DOGE employee should have access to any of Americans' sensitive confidential information, and they should not have access to be able to stop payments. Now, my understanding is just yesterday, the Treasury Secretary said that they will not have that access and they are not going to have any control over the payments. That, in my view, is because we have pushed back so hard on what's going on, not members of Congress or senators, but the American public, and the administration is taking note. So we need to continue to push back against this completely unconstitutional effort.
Would you say it's fair to say you know Elon Musk well? Can you talk about your exchanges with him?
Well, I've known him. I wouldn't say, you know, well as relative, but I've known him since 2010 or 11, after when I was in the Obama administration. Of course, he was a supporter of President Obama, and he blurbed one of my first books, which I talked about bringing manufacturing back to America. We always had a disagreement about Tesla's unionization. Tesla's in my district. I have been a very vocal advocate that they should be unionizing, that they should be using union labor. But other than that, I said that, you know, would discuss with him renewable energy, discuss with him issues of climate, discuss with him issues of China. And believe that in many ways he was a very, very strong technology entrepreneur. But it has really been disappointing and concerning to see the overreach and the unconstitutional actions. There's just no justification for that. And I've said to him directly, I've said, if you believe that you found fraud, you found waste, you found an exposed abuse, bring that to the American people, bring it to Congress. But you can't make those decisions unilaterally.
I wanted to go to a Mother Jones interview you did in December when you said Democrats shouldn't write off DOGE, that they should work with Musk. Do you still believe that at this point?
Well, no, not. I mean, look, what I said then, I stand by, which is that the defense budget is bloated. I am often the only vote against a $1 trillion defense budget, that the five primes have too much power. And if Musk is talking about making the Defense Department more competitive or looking at wasteful spending in the Pentagon, that we should have engaged him. But at this point, until there is an ironclad commitment that he is going to come to Congress, that he is not going to stop payments arbitrarily, even payments to the Pentagon arbitrarily, obviously we can't work on anything until then. There has to be first a clear commitment to the Constitution.
So there's been a lot of criticism of Democrats around their inability to challenge Trump's agenda right now and whether the courts ultimately stop it. Who knows how many federal workers there will be left. Can you talk about what you feel needs to happen at this point?
Well, one, we need to be willing to speak out and speak out clearly and face the consequences. Obviously, I spoke out very, very forcefully on the Oversight Committee hearing. It elicited a response from Musk. But we need to stand up clearly, all of us, and say this is unconstitutional. We are going to stand for the separation of powers. You can't unilaterally stop payments. You can't unilaterally fire federal workers. Second, we need to show that we have a plan, that we're not going to raise the debt ceiling if they continue to do these kind of antics. That vote is coming up in March. We know President Trump follows the stock market. We know President Sheinbaum and Prime Minister Trudeau actually stood up to his bullying on some of the irrational tariff policy on foods because he saw that the market was going to fall. We can do the same thing with our leverage in the House. And finally, we need to show up everywhere. Show up on your show, show up on podcasts, show up outside with federal workers to show and stand in solidarity. I do think, Amy, there is a movement now which is pushing back. We did not have that for a couple months. I acknowledge that. But the Democratic Party in this last week has had a new energy and a new resolve to stand up.
To get your comment on the reopening of Guantanamo for migrants, already the first plane load of migrants sent to Guantanamo, you have Kristi Noem, the new head of Homeland Security, already going there. Your comments on Guantanamo and then also on the 100 Indian deportees who apparently were shackled in a flight for 40 hours back to India.
Well, Guantanamo needs to close. I have been saying that for many, many years, and it's appalling that we would be expanding Guantanamo, where already there are issues of civil liberties. And obviously, anyone needs to be treated with dignity. But there's a bigger issue here, Amy. You have President Trump talking about taking over Greenland. You have him talking about taking over Panama. You have him talking about making Canada the 51st state. You have him talking about Colombia and forcing Colombia to take military flights of migrants, totally oblivious to the history of the 1928 Banana Massacre, totally oblivious to the history of the United States' support of the military regime in Colombia. You have Donald Trump talking about mass displacement in Gaza with no recognition of Palestinian self-determination. I think he is in the wrong century. The 19th century colonialism and imperialism is what my grandfather stood up to with alongside Gandhi in the Indian independence movement. And we need to be very, very clear, not just in condemning these individual actions, but in condemning a project of American expansionism that violates the dignities and self-determination of people around the world.
Your comments on Netanyahu gifting Trump a golden pager to memorialize the thousands of pagers that blew up in the faces of doctors and other people in Lebanon that Israel booby-trapped?
Well, it was appalling, and it's the cruelty that I find so disheartening. You know, I feel an anger, but I feel a sadness as an American, because our best traditions as Americans, though not perfect, is at least standing up or aspiring for human rights, aspiring to stand up for the dignity and worth of every human being. And even where we haven't lived up to those ideals, we at least strive for those ideals. And this is a total rejection and almost celebration of killing. And it is a strain in America, but it is not, in my view, the essential strain. And somehow we have to overcome this by standing on principle. But I was truly appalled by that. And I was appalled by denying Palestinians any sense of self-determination. Even if it was done with as a joke, even if it's done as an outlandish proposal, it is so offensive to say to all Palestinians, go move, and we're not going to listen to what you want to do about Gaza.
Congressmember O'Connor, I want to thank you for being with us. Democratic Congressmember from California, Deputy Whip of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, speaking to us from the Cannon Rotunda. Next up, we look at the legal hurdles facing Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE. Stay with us. Now to Love by Anastasia. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We look now at some of the new legal hurdles facing Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, as it tries to dismantle and destruct and restructure, as it says, multiple federal agencies. On Thursday, a lawsuit by a coalition of labor unions prompted the Labor Department to agree not to release any sensitive economic and privacy data to DOGE. The agency holds sensitive data, likely including worker complaints against Musk and his companies. The lawsuit argues, quote, DOGE seeks to gain access to sensitive systems before courts can stop them, dismantle agencies before Congress can assert its prerogatives in the federal budget, and intimidate and threaten employees who stand in their way. The results have already been catastrophic. DOGE has seized control of some of the most carefully protected information systems housed at the Treasury Department, taken hold of all sensitive personnel information at the Office of Personnel Management, and dismantled an entire agency within a week. A full hearing on the case is set for today. This comes as a similar lawsuit filed this week resulted in another agreement Thursday to stop DOGE from accessing millions of sensitive personal and financial records from the Treasury Department. The case was filed by Public Citizen on behalf of the American Federation of Government Employees, the Service Employees International Union, and the Alliance for Retired Americans. For more, we're joined by two guests. In Washington, D.C., Robert Weissman is with us, co-president of Public Citizen, which is also sued to stop the Trump administration's attack on the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID. And in Arlington, Virginia, Rob Shriver is with us, senior advisor to Democracy Forward, which filed the lawsuit over Labor Department data on behalf of a coalition of labor unions. Until days ago, he was the acting director of the Office of Personnel Management under the Biden administration. Welcome you both to Democracy Now! Rob Shriver, let's begin with you. Is Elon Musk committing crimes here?
So, Amy, that it remains to be seen. But I think what we know right now is there are huge problems with what Elon Musk and his team are doing to access the most critical personal data that this country owns. There are processes in place that protect that data from public disclosure, that make sure that it's used appropriately and not to engage in retribution or gain competitive advantages. And I think the complaint that Democracy Forward filed on behalf of 4 million workers lays out in great detail the risk and the harm that is already happening.
Talk about the information that is at risk here. And the young men, 19 to 26, who used to work for SpaceX or X or Tesla, Elon Musk's private companies, who have access to this information.
Yeah, I think that latter part is incredibly alarming. We don't know if these individuals are employees of the government. We don't know if they've gone through any vetting process. You know, the background investigation process is not just some technical HR thing that people get annoyed about. It's meant to determine whether people are subject to blackmail or foreign agents or of such questionable character that they can't be trusted with sensitive data. So to bypass that process, which if that happened, would be a huge problem, we need to know, the American people need to know, what has happened to get these people access. And then the types of data that you're talking about include personally identifiable information, personal health records, data about workers' compensation claims, data about Elon Musk's competitors, and some of the data that our economy relies upon to be reported out objectively and without political interference.
Can you tell us what the agency that you were in charge of, the Office of Personnel Management, I mean, it sounds so bureaucratic, it's hard for people to identify with it, what the information you held there is and why it's so threatening? And can you talk, for example, about Medicaid?
Sure. So OPM is essentially the HR agency of the federal government. It issues HR policy. It manages and processes retirements for federal employees. It also manages the largest group health insurance program in the world, the Federal Employee Health Benefits Program. So in order to carry out all of those functions, which, by the way, are largely nonpartisan, right? Like most of the time, OPM spends like just processing these retirement applications, managing health insurance, largely nonpartisan. But to carry out those missions, it has data on millions and millions of Americans, not just the 2.3 million active federal employees, but also the millions more retirees, the 8 million people who are enrolled in the Federal Employee Health Benefit Program, which includes federal employees, their family members, some of the highest ranking officials in government, including members of Congress. So all of that data is housed at OPM and subject to very strict rules and controls for who gets to access it, for what purpose. There are immense cybersecurity protections because the country may remember a large data breach in 2015 involving OPM that exposed millions of records of federal employees and family members. So, and as a result of that, there are extensive protections in place to prevent something like that from happening again.
I want to go to Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey, who was with Congressmembers Paul Tonko and Yasmin Ansari, turned away from EPA headquarters. This is Senator Markey speaking at a news conference outside the EPA after they were denied entry.
We just went in and asked for a meeting with the DOGE representatives. We were denied. We were turned away. And we just had a couple of simple questions for them. Are they still freezing EPA funding for all of the clean air and clean water programs in our country? Are they blocking the important work which the EPA does on a daily basis to protect the people in our country, the families of our country? And they did not give us the answers in the same way that they are not giving the answers to every other program in our country. Medicaid, Medicare, the Affordable Care Act, all of those health and environmental programs that are so central to the well-being of every family in our country. Trump and Elon Musk and their unqualified, unelected, unwanted henchmen want to be able to carry out their attacks on your environment, your rights, your friends, your neighbors, under the cover of darkness. So we're outside asking them to step out into the light of day.
So that's Massachusetts Senator Markey standing outside the EPA. He stopped from going inside. Agencies like this, I mean, we're talking about Treasury Department as well, senators and congressmember, police stopping them from moving in. But the DOGE kids, right, 19, 20, 21, 22, they're moving in. How much information they're getting is not clear. I want to bring Rob Weissman into this conversation. Robert Weissman is head of Public Citizen. Can you talk about this? What is happening right now and what your lawsuit is all about?
Yeah, thanks, Amy. I think the broad story is that Elon Musk and his acolytes are on an authoritarian rampage through the government. It's only sort of ideological. It may be serving his business interests, we don't know. But it's designed to access information, surveil the country, destroy the institutions of government, and advance corporate interests without restraint. I think for Elon Musk, it's fair to say he views this all as a kind of fun video game that he's going to play for a little while, then walk away. It's been reported that the White House doesn't actually know what Musk is doing in detail, but is fine. They have a kind of plausible deniability. When things go really wrong, then they pull it back in and tell him, don't do that again. So we are really in a dangerous time. We're going to have to rely at first on the courts to restrain this. That's what the Democracy Forward lawsuit's about. It's what we've done at the Department of Treasury, where we were able to get an order yesterday restraining DOGE from accessing information at the Treasury Department, although still allowing two Musk acolytes inside the Treasury Department to get access to that information, now down to one because of the resignation you referenced earlier. This information is people's tax data. It's the government's payment data. So it's almost everyone in the country, personal information, income, and more, access to information about government payees. And it's not just that they want to see the information. It's clear and been reported that their desire is to be able to cut off payments to people and organizations and corporations, contractors, whatever, that are due payment through appropriate, you know, through congressionally appropriated money, through contractually obligated money, just to cut it off. That's their version of efficiency. It has nothing to do with efficiency. It's all about authoritarian imposition. And by the way, eventually people who lose money are going to be paid. So the idea that they're saving money is a lie. They're going to be costing money, even in the direct sense, beyond the massive harm they're going to inflict in this country and around the world.
Rob Weissman, Public Citizen recently filed a complaint with the Department of Justice urging an examination into whether FBI Director nominee Kash Patel should have registered under FARA, the Foreign Agents Registration Act. Explain why.
Well, in the course of seeking a nomination for a position like Director of the FBI, individuals are required to make all kinds of disclosures. That's considered by the Senate as part of the confirmation process. Kash Patel did not disclose to the Senate in time for his consideration, for his confirmation hearings, that he had been paid by the government of Qatar to do work. We don't know exactly what. That information has now come out. There's a question first why it wasn't disclosed, and that the Senate should be able to ask him, what were you doing? And consider whether it wants to confirm as head of the FBI someone who is a paid agent for a foreign country. There's also the non-trivial legal matter that you're required to register when you work for foreign governments, which Kash Patel did not do. Now, an extra interesting twist in this is the new Attorney General, Pam Bondi, also worked for Qatar. She did follow the requirements and register under the Foreign Agents Registration Act. But in her first day in office yesterday, she issued a memo in which she said, you know what, we're not going to enforce that law very much. By and large, you can violate the law unless you're engaged in espionage on behalf of a foreign country. So the new attorney general, who would be overseeing Kash Patel if he were confirmed, has already pre-announced that she won't really investigate this claim against Kash Patel, which is a serious one because it's plain he didn't file the registration requirements.
Speaking of Pam Bondi, the new attorney general, within her first days in office, she has done everything from ordering investigations into sanctuary cities to reinstating the federal death penalty. Does she have that power?
Well, the attorney general has a lot of power and a lot of discretionary decision-making authority. It's very likely she's going to overstep it. No one should be surprised. She got the job because she was an ardent Donald Trump supporter. She maintained that through her confirmation hearing. She should not have been confirmed. She's multiply conflicted with companies that the Department of Justice is or will be investigating. She proved herself unqualified by her devotion to Donald Trump and her defense of the coup on January 6th. But we are here where we are, and she's going to use both the discretionary, legitimate discretionary authority of the Attorney General and illegitimate authority of the Attorney General. One of her memos yesterday basically informed the Justice Department workforce, hey, your job is to work for Donald Trump, and we expect you to be loyal to the president's mission and priorities. Well, that's not the job of the Department of Justice. The Department of Justice is not the president's lawyer. The Department of Justice are the people's lawyers and required to uphold the laws of this country. And it's going to be a tough time in the next few years. We're going to see how vindictive she is, but the best case scenario isn't very good at all.
Public Citizen has filed a complaint with the Department of Justice and the Office of Government Ethics around President Trump, on January 17th, days before he was inaugurated, releasing an official Trump meme coin, which value skyrocketed to over $15 billion. What can you say about this?
Yeah, at a different time, this would be headline stories for a couple of weeks, but there's too much craziness and danger going on. So Trump launched this meme a couple of days before the inauguration. He's promoted it on Twitter and on Truth Social since he was inaugurated, saying, buy the meme. When you get the meme, you're essentially getting nothing. You pay what you pay. And Trump says it's not an investment. It's just support for an idea. So effectively, you're making a gift to Donald Trump. You can try to resell that gift if you want, but you're basically making a gift to Donald Trump. That's illegal for every federal employee except for the president, who can't accept gifts. but the president is not permitted to solicit gifts. So we have argued that the idea that he's asking people to buy this meme, which is a valueless thing, not a security, as he says, constitutes the solicitation of a gift, and we've asked for an investigation.
Finally, I want to go back to Rob Shriver about the tactics in court and on the streets right now. Tens of thousands of federal workers have accepted the email, the resignation, resigning and being paid for the next 8 months. First of all, will they necessarily get that? Now, that's been stopped. The deadline was supposed to be last night at midnight, and a judge said no. But talk about what this means. You represent so many unions. And also, is the federal workforce one of the most diverse in the country? Is that also why it's being targeted?
Well, I think that's a good question. Certainly, we have worked over multiple administrations to make the federal workforce reflect the diversity of America through legitimate tactics like making sure we're recruiting broadly for talent. I think it's really important that Democracy Forward went to court and got this extension on the deadline because the fork in the road offer is unprecedented. It's not consistent with the legal approaches that an administration can use to do exactly this. Why haven't they just offered federal employees early retirement across the board? Why haven't they gone through the congressionally authorized separation program that is implemented by OPM regulations? And then in addition to that, there are budgetary questions, right? We're on a continuing resolution through March 14th. What's to stop the Republican-controlled Congress in enacting a new budget from saying, we're not going to honor this agreement to pay people not to do their job? And then lastly, the American people need to ask, what is the plan for delivering essential government services? What is the plan if a bunch of national security workers take this deal? Or if an entire office in a county in Iowa of USDA workers takes that deal? Who's going to help those farmers?
I want to thank you both for being with us. Rob Shriver, senior advisor for Democracy Forward, former acting director of OPM. That's the Office of Personnel Management. And Robert Weissman, co-president of Public Citizen. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll speak with the former head of the EPA's Environmental Justice Program, which the Trump administration is trying to shut down. Back in 20 seconds.
For righteousness, they build the arrow to shoot it straight into their lives. Who would expect the mighty sparrow, oh, to rid our world of all their kind, rising up and taking back property of every man? It's so easy, so, so easy.
The whole point of No Return by the Style Council. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show with President Trump's moves to shut down the Environmental Protection Agency's Office of Environmental Justice and External Civil Rights. On Thursday, 168 workers of the Environmental Justice Office were placed on leave. The office was first established in 1992 after research showed communities with hazardous waste sites had a higher percentage of Black and low-income residents. For more, we're joined in Washington, D.C. by Mustafa Santiago Ali, the former head of the EPA's Environmental Justice Program. He resigned in 2017 to protest a Trump administration proposal to severely scale back the agency. So you resigned under Trump administration one. Now it's not scaling back. It's shutting it down. Can you talk first about what environmental justice is and what it will mean?
Yeah. Well, environmental justice deals with the disproportionate impacts that happen in communities of color and lower wealth communities. And those communities are everywhere from Appalachia to Flint, Michigan, to the Navajo Nation. It makes sure that folks have a voice, makes sure that they have an opportunity to play a role in the impacts that are happening in their communities. It also helps them to be able to play a role in moving from surviving to thriving.
And so you have 168, some people are saying 200 workers within the environmental justice program put on leave. So what happens to communities across the country?
Well, they're now placed in a much dangerous situation because they no longer have that advocate for them inside of the Environmental Protection Agency. You know, we have over 100 million people in our country right now who are dealing with unsafe air, whether it's from ozone, particulate matter, or a number of other things. And many times our most vulnerable communities are the ones who are carrying those burdens. So they no longer have someone to make sure that they have the information that they need and that they have the ability to work with the agency and others to address that. We know that we've got all these dangerous chemicals that are in our waters right now, everything from lead. And we saw what happened in Flint, Michigan, and Benton Harbor, and a number of other locations across our country. But we also have things like TCE and forever chemicals, and a number of other things that are just very deadly. So they no longer have someone, a place to be able to go to understand how to navigate these very dangerous situations that they're often facing. They also no longer will have the resources that are necessary to help their groups to be able to properly advocate, to help to make change happen inside of their communities.
The Guardian has an article headlined, Trump's proposed EPA leadership stacked with lobbyists and attorneys. What concerns you most about the EPA right now? And what message do you have right now? Hundreds of EPA career workers have left. ProPublica reports those who remain feel deeply torn. You quit under the first Trump administration. What message do you have for those who are remaining?
Well, first, I'm very concerned about the deregulation and the focus on corporate profits, because anytime that we place profit over people, then we are putting a crosshair on our most vulnerable, our most marginalized. For all those brothers and sisters who are still there at the agency, and for those who have been put on leave, I would give them the words of my grandmother, that you have power unless you give it away. And that means that not only them, but citizens across our country who believe that everyone has the right to have clean air and clean water for their children, to be able to be on land that is free from toxic pollution, then we have to raise our voices. We have to get engaged. We have to make sure that folks understand that this is not an American value, and that we also have to understand that there is power inside of our vote. I never tell anyone who to vote for, but I do say you should be thinking very clearly about voting for somebody who cares about your communities. So don't give up your power. Continue to build relationships together and stand in solidarity.
Last week, the Senate confirmed former Long Island Republican Congressman Lee Zeldin as head of the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency. Three Democrats joined with the Republicans in the vote. Arizona Senators Ruben Gallego and Mark Kelly, Pennsylvania Senator John Fetterman, Youth Climate Action Group Sunrise Movement condemned Zeldin's confirmation as a disaster for the planet and a win for fossil fuel executives, writing, quote, he took $420,000 from big oil, pledged to undo climate protections, and has been all in with Trump, backing corporate polluters at the expense of working people. In this last minute that we have together, Mustafa, where do you see this country going right now? You just stood with other climate activists outside protesting. What is your ultimate demand?
Well, our ultimate demand is to stop placing these crosshairs on vulnerable communities and communities across our country. We should be focused on making sure that folks' health is being improved and not, you know, having a situation where folks are going to be sicker. Their actions also will make us poorer, because we know that the focus for the 21st century has to be on a cleaner economy. So once again, we have the opportunity to move people from surviving to thriving. But the current sets of actions that they're moving forward on is going to do absolutely the opposite.
Mustafa Santiago Ali, we thank you so much for being with us. Former head of the Environmental Justice Program at the Environmental Protection Agency. It is now in the Trump administration's crosshairs. 168 workers at least have been put on leave. He is now the executive vice president of the National Wildlife Federation. That does it for our show, Democracy Now!, produced with Mayna Feldstein, Nick Guzder, Messiah Ridz, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warren, Afterina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Asti, Joe John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Hani Massoud, Hannah Elias. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You've got your radio tuned to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Coming up in just a moment is Pinckney Hall.
Speaks or spells. Is this more important than the stories that he tells? And call a man a fool if all wealth he doesn't strive. Well then, mister, you're a better man than I. Yeah, mister, you're a better man than I. Well, mister, you're a better man than I. Yeah, mister, you're a better man.
Pinckney Hall on WRCT Pittsburgh. I'm Kenny Joe. I will be your radio host for the next hour or so. The song you just heard was by the Yardbirds, Mister, You're a Better Man Than I, off of their second U.S. release CD, Rave Up. Interestingly, this song was, I think it was probably the first one they recorded with Jeff Beck as their lead guitar player. I mention that because the theme today is going to be notable guitar parts. So we're starting it off that way. A notable fact here is this song was recorded by, it was produced by Sam Phillips in Memphis, something I didn't know until relatively recently. I didn't even know that the Yardbirds had been in the U.S. before this song. So, okay. Seems to me I'm missing something I should be telling you here, but I can't think of what it is. Maybe it'll come to me. Okay. going to give you a couple of PSAs here, and then we will get back to guitar players. Today in the United States,